From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzio, host of Jake and Gino Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barber. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, I'm doing great, brother. How you doing?
Always making it happen, big man. Today's guest is a best-selling author, TEDx speaker, and founder of 12 companies. It's like Gino having kids over there. He just keeps cranking them out. He's on a mission to help 100,000 entrepreneurs find true success and balance by using his proven method, Exit Without Exiting. Gino, it sounds like a refi to me, but we're about to get into this. So without further ado, Jason Duncan, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, fellas.
Hey, happy to have you here. Let's dive into it. Let's get to know each other a little better. Please share with us your background and how you got started in business.
Well, I started my first big company as an unemployed school teacher in 2010. So I spent the first 13 years of my career, I was in ministry. And then I got sick of doing that. So I went and got a master's in education, started teaching school, taught school for 4 years. And then my contract didn't get renewed due to the recession back in 08, 09. And I had to make a decision. So I decided to go the entrepreneur route, started a company, and turned out pretty well. So I built a multi-million-dollar company. And then in 2020, I exited the daily operations of that company. I did what I now call Exit Without Exiting. I still own it. And but I went on to start several other companies, and people were like, how did you do that? How did you get out of daily ops without having to sell the company? So I turned it into a program and a platform, and now I coach and teach at that. I wrote a book about it, Exit Without Exiting. I speak on it. That's what I do now.
Jason, why did you get out of ministry? What happened after 13 years?
Yeah, you just can't burned say out? You got sick of it either, man. God's going to get upset with you here. What's going on?
No, I think he's got a lot more things to worry about. when you're behind the curtain, you know, and I love Jesus, always follow Jesus, still follow Jesus to this day. So it has nothing to do with him. But when you're behind the curtain in ministry, you get to see things that probably, you know, don't line up with what we read about in scriptures and what we think Jesus really intended. And so I just looked around and I thought, you know, this is not what I can't make the difference here that I need to make. So I started praying about, well, where can I go? What can I do to make the difference? And that's when I decided, you know, I'm going to go be a school teacher. So I taught eighth grade American history and honestly thought I would continue doing that for the rest of my life had it not been for the budget cuts. But yeah, that's why I got out of ministry.
I was just going to say, going from being a minister to a school teacher, I mean, teaching is not much better. It's a really painful occupation dealing with eighth graders about history. I mean, that's got to be a tough thing. And the budget cuts are probably a blessing, like you said. But why did you pick teaching from ministry? Was it just in you to teach others?
Well, you know, I don't know specifically, but I can tell you what I think. If I go back to when I was in elementary school, I remember writing what I wanted to be when I grew up. And one of the things I wanted to be was a farmer. One of the things was a professional baseball player, and one was a teacher. I don't have any idea why I picked any of those things. I never was a professional baseball player, played for 10 years and quit in my freshman year of high school. Never grew anything, don't care about farming whatsoever. But then this teaching thing, when I had the opportunity, I thought, well, what can I do to make a difference in this world? Listen, what better difference could I make than at the time I thought was just teaching kids. So I started thinking about what that might look like. And from two weeks, almost to the day when I made that decision, I had money given to me and was enrolled and accepted into a master's program. Well, in 2 weeks, like the decision was made. And within 2 weeks, it was all taken care of. And I started a program and that's how it started.
And how did you decide upon your first business? How did you launch it? What was the business all about? And how did you come to the decision of that industry?
Well, so I at the time knew nothing about lighting at all. I really didn't know anything about business. I had started back in 1995. The first company I ever started was a website design company in 1995. So for the listeners who know kind of where the World Wide Web started, that's when it started. So I was on the cutting edge, but I didn't know anything about business. And so it didn't last. I wasn't very good at it. I didn't do a very good job. Shut that down. And then fast forward 20 plus years later, I decide I need to start a business. Well, actually, it's not exactly that clear cut. I had a friend of mine. His name was Bill. Bill reached out to me in 2010 and he said, "Hey, Jason, I think I want to start. I've got this invention idea. I want to start a business with you. Are you interested?" And I said, "Well, not really, but you know, I'll listen. I like Bill. Bill's a good dude." He was not quite old enough to be my grandfather, old enough to be my dad, just a kind of a mad scientist guy. I just found out within the last month or so that he passed away. And I've lost touch with Bill over these years, but we started the company based on his insistence that we could create this hydrogen generator for cars, an on-demand hydrogen generator. And he said, "Look, you're good with people. You're good at teaching. You could probably go help us sell this stuff. Let's just do this. It'll be nights and weekends and summer stuff for you as a teacher. You don't have to stop teaching." So I agreed. We started the company. And over the course of the next year, I'm still teaching school. We got this thing running in the background. We're building this crap like mad scientists out in my shed. I actually ended up making my son's go-kart run off hydrogen that we just figured out how to cobble together these parts and pieces. It was actually very interesting. But I'm not a scientist. I'm not an inventor. And so that's what we did. Now, in the spring of 2011, my principal came to me and shared the news that he had to cut two teaching positions the following school year. And I was the lowest man on the totem pole. I was the number one teacher in the county for my subject matter by test scores. I was a really good teacher. But he said, "Man, this is how I got to make my decision. I'm really, really sorry."
And that's why the schools are failing.
Yeah, this is what's going on. That's how they make their decisions. So I looked at all my options, go corporate route, get another teaching job. Okay, teaching job was what I wanted to do, but there were no teaching jobs to have. I mean, the Great Recession like killed education first before COVID did. So it gets first dibs at killing education. So it wasn't available to me. So then I looked at the corporate route. I didn't really find anything I wanted. So I thought, well, let me take this business and see if I could do something with it. And I knew hydrogen was never going to work long-term. Like, that's not my thing. So the business was named Future Vision Energy. And I looked at it, I thought, well, what can I do around the energy concept that doesn't require me to invent something to create energy? Can I do something to sell energy efficiency? Because I kind of dig that. And LED lighting kind of came up as an idea. And at the time, it was just becoming commercially viable. And that's why I went into that business. So I completely retooled the company to be a lighting company, a retrofit company for LEDs. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, but the history, there's a big span in between starting it and exiting it. Let's get into that a little bit because, you know, listeners out here, it's like buying a multifamily. I mean, there's a lot of groundwork to get into, a lot of education, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, a lot of time dedicated. What was the first step you took? I mean, just going out from the hydrogen thing, so all of a sudden going to the electric, you've got the business plan, you've got the idea. How do you start implementing? What are the first few things you start doing?
Well, I think just with anything else, it's who you know, not what you know. So I started making connections. I started making phone calls, started visiting factories, visiting manufacturing companies about LED lighting. And it ended up working. I mean, I don't know if I fooled these people into that I knew something that I didn't, but I had manufacturing companies that said, "Yeah, we'll sell to you. And here's our pricing." And I to think back what it would originally cost, like a 4-foot LED tube light, which is like what replaces fluorescent lights. At the time, they were $45.
They're expensive.
Yeah. They were very expensive. I mean, today they're a few bucks. I mean, it's changed that fast over these last 10 or 15 years. But I thought, you know, I could probably do this. And then it was cold calling. I mean, you guys that are in real estate, you know what that's like. Gap, the clothing company, right? Gap has their largest North American distribution center in the town that I live in. I didn't really know anything about it other than there it was. One day I'm driving down the street and I look over and I see their distribution center, 2.8 million square feet. And I thought, okay, they need lights. Let me call them. So I'm on my phone, literally out of the like stop sign, and I'm Googling Gap Distribution Center, Gallatin, Tennessee. And I was in the sixth or seventh page of Google before I got any phone number associated with that distribution center. And I just hit dial. And the person answered the phone. They said, "IT, Like, this is no kid. It was an internal number I'd found somewhere on Google. And the guy said, IT. And I said, man, you're going to think I'm crazy, but I have a really weird question for you. And he was like, okay. I said, how much is your electric bill at a building like that? That's huge. And he hung up on me. He immediately hung up. And I thought, well, this is a big company, so there's probably other people that will answer the phone. So I dialed back. And sure enough, a different dude answered. Now, what I know today is there are only two guys in the IT department. So the other guy answered. So the other guy answers, and he got IT. And I said, man, I got disconnected, but I was asking this question. And I repeated my question. And he said, well, hang on a minute. So he puts me on hold, and I just waited. And it seemed like forever. It was over a minute, which is forever to be on hold like that. But I'm waiting. And a lady's voicemail comes on. And it's, I don't remember her name, but we'll call her Sarah. So Sarah's say, hey, I'm Sarah, blah, 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 with Gap, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, I'm breaking the rule of sales by phone, but I'm going to leave a message. So I left the message with my question, and that was it. I thought they'll never call me back. And I just kept on about my day. 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from a guy named Eric. And Eric says, hey, I'm the facilities manager at Gap Distribution Center. I understand you have a question about our electric bill. I thought, oh, yeah, I do, actually. And so I gave him the spiel. And I said, look, I can help you save millions of dollars. I just want to meet with you. And he granted me the meeting. We ended up selling Gap millions and millions of dollars worth of lights and did projects for them all over North America. It was pretty phenomenal.
What are some of the most important hires you've made along the way to be able to scale? Because you can't be driving down the street, looking at distributions and trying to give them a call.
Well, I think early on, having the right assistant was really, really critical and crucial. The lady who is, she's actually was one of my first assistants at my lighting company. ELS is the name of the company now, an energy lighting services. We rebranded. But I hired her at a Starbucks. Got to have an office. I hired her at a Starbucks back, golly, it's almost 10 years ago. And today she's the vice president of finance and administration. And she was the glue that kind of kept things going early on. I hired an operations guy named Ricky right out of college to handle all the operations, you know, going in and counting light bulbs and ordering light bulbs and working with crews to organize projects, et cetera. So those were probably two of the most critical hires early. And they're both, I'm happy to say, still with me to this day.
And as you're scaling up the company, what are some of the mistakes that you made?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I could write a whole book on that. I think one of the mistakes I made is I built this as a job rather than a business. And that's what so many entrepreneurs do. They build jobs, not businesses. And they decide, well, I'll go do it on my own. I still got to show up 40, 50, 60 hours a week. I'll get paid a lot more, sure, but everything is on my shoulders. And that's what I did. I did that wrong. I didn't understand the mistake of that for 7 years into the process. So I was kind of a slow learner. I also, one of the mistakes was not hiring a business coach early, although to my defense, I didn't even know what a business coach was early on. Didn't even know those things existed. But when I finally hired a business coach, that's when everything changed. That's when I became a millionaire. That's when really life began to change. Business began to change. Options and opportunities began to open up.
What did the business coach help you with?
Seeing what I can't see. You know, when you're in your own business, I mean, you're looking through blinders. You know, you're like a horse with blinders. You can see straight in front of you and that's it. And you don't see everything else. And you live and you breathe and you eat and you sleep and everything is business, your business. Business coach comes in with their blinders off. They have a 180-degree perspective of what's happening. And so his name was BJ Howard. And so BJ came in and sat down with me and started asking me questions about my business. And I hired him for the purpose of just showing me, how do we accelerate this? How do we build it bigger? How do we make this better? And over the course of working with him for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, it wasn't about making it better. It was about making it operate on its own. How do I do that? And when I realized that I was trapped in my own business, that's when I decided to figure a way out.
This is a two-part question. Can you just describe to the listeners what your definition of a job versus a business is, and what did you do to transition from the job to the business?
So the definition of a job versus owning a business. So a job is something that someone else pays you to do to show up and perform certain tasks. And if you don't perform those tasks, not only do you not get paid, but those tasks don't get completed and the business can can have a detrimental effect to the business. That's a job. That's a job. Owning a business should be about the business being able to run through systems and processes and investments in the right people to make it run on its own, so that I receive income and a financial benefit as the owner of the business. So job ownership is very similar to business ownership, but you're really your own employee. You have to show up every day. And if you don't show up, if you don't do the work, don't put in the work, it doesn't happen. It's detrimental to the business. You could lose your job by losing the business.
And what did you do to turn yourself from that job into the business?
Well, the first thing you got to do is you got to have the mindset. You got to have a clear understanding of what business ownership is for. I believe that business ownership is not about having a better job. It's about having a better life. It's about having a business that can provide you the financial and tax resources and to live the lifestyle that you desire. So from a mindset perspective, I think it's about building a business around your life, not a life around your business. And while that may seem like not very big of a difference, but you can look at most entrepreneurs, their life is around the business. And what I'd rather have is a business around my life. In other words, I'm going to live the lifestyle that I want, and the business supports that. So mindset-wise, you first got to understand that. Second, I think you have to first understand that you're not the hero of your business. You know, in the first year or so, it's okay to be the hero of your business. It's okay to put the cape on, swoop in, save the day, you know, save the baby, you know, put out the fires, rescue the damsel in distress. But ultimately, we don't hear about trillion-dollar businesses who have hero entrepreneurs running them. You know, Steve Jobs wasn't the hero entrepreneur of Apple. He got out of the way and let other people do things. And now it's a trillion-dollar company, the world's first trillion-dollar company. If he had stayed in the weeds of operations as the job owner, we would not know his name and we would not know Apple. So to transition, you've got to understand, I can't be the hero of the company. So you've got to delegate. You've got to eliminate stress. You got to establish the right systems and processes. And you have to invest in people correctly.
And when did you get the idea of exit without exiting?
Well, that's actually very interesting, because when I sat down with BJ and I was asking him about the business, one of the questions he asked me is, he said, so what would you be doing if you weren't running this company? Like if you could choose what you want to do, because I didn't really choose lighting, although I kind of did. It was just there and I just retooled it to make it work. But if I could go back in time with all my knowledge, would I start a lighting company? No. I would not have started a lighting company because I don't have any passion. It's not about, I don't enjoy it. Now, was I able to build something significant and affect a lot of lives as a result of it? Yes, I was. And so you don't have to like it to be successful at it, but it helps. So I said, well, I would probably be in the car business or the motorcycle business. I love motorcycles. I would do something around some things I like. And he said, okay, well, why don't we figure out how to help you build a life to where you can do more of that? And I said, well, why don't we just figure out how to sell this company and then I'll have time to go do that? Because we had a strong 7-figure bottom line. We were doing really, really well. We've been listed in Inc. magazine, Entrepreneur magazine. I mean, we were doing the things you're supposed to do as an entrepreneurial company. But he said, Jason, your company's not worth anything. I said, how can it not be worth anything? I mean, I'm making $1 million a year. How can it not be worth anything? He goes, well, because it requires you and nobody's going to buy it if you're not staying. And that was that realization moment. Like, man, I got to get out of the way. I got to figure this out. So when I started figuring out how to do it without selling it, I was able to accomplish that in about 18 months. I was able to step away from full daily operational control of the company. I put my department directors in charge, gave them raises and, you know, to commensurate with the extra expectations. Ultimately, I brought in a new CEO. We're partnering with another company in a different state to help us offset some of the, you know, things that we don't have that they have and vice versa. So I built it. And when I got out, I was like, hey, I exited, but I really didn't exit. So it was kind of, that's when the phrase exit without exiting was born. And I was working with a different coach by this time. And he said, exit without exiting, man, that's your thing. He said, nobody's talking about that. He said, you need to go with this. This is what you need to talk about. So that's what I started talking about.
And Jason, when you start a company now, do you have that mindset right now, starting a company with the exit in mind?
100%. You have to, anything worth doing, you should start with the end in mind. What is the end of the matter? Now, I'm not talking about relationships. That's obviously a different thing. Don't think about that when you get married. That's a different, whole different story. But when you're starting a task or a project or a company, you have to start with the end in mind. What, where are we heading with this? So one of my clients, one of my coaching clients said that, you know, he goes, I know, Jason, you talk about exit without exiting, but you helped us. What do you say? Exit without entering, because he was starting a business. He's like, I didn't even get involved. He said, I started this business and I made sure that from day one that I had the people, the processes, all the stuff put together so that the company could run by itself. And, you know, I think you can live an amazing lifestyle without having to run the business. I think it's about being an owner investor, not the owner operator.
Jake, this is very similar to multifamily, isn't it? You buy your first deal. You never think of the exit. You just think of, I need to buy a deal, brother. I need to make that cash flow. And you never think about, what are you going to do with this deal 3 or 4 or 5 years? And then your second deal, you're like, huh, am I going to hold this deal for the long term? Am I going to refi this deal? Am I going to sell this deal? Should I even be buying this deal? So it's interesting because multifamily, everyone thinks about it as real estate, but it really isn't just real estate. It really is a multifamily entrepreneurial venture. And I think that's what's important. You know, we're talking right now about business, everybody, but it's so relevant to investing in real estate. And I think the people who fail in real estate see it as just, hey, a couple of like little properties here. I'm going to try to accumulate some. I'm not really going to try to build any systems. But as you get bigger and you start scaling, you start putting in these different systems as Jason's talking about, you can do it in multifamily real estate with the manage right portion. Not many people talk about manage right because it's not sexy, but that's where you make the money. So as you're doing this, what are some of the things that people need to implement in their business to be able to think about exit it without exiting?
So there are four key components that I teach, four core principles. And so in my book, I actually tell the story of three different entrepreneurs in the book and how they went through these four core principles and how some did them better than others. But the idea first is you have to embrace delegation. You got to understand that you can't do it on your own. What I found now from coaching these past 3 years and speaking and helping thousands of entrepreneurs understand this, it's that most people don't know what delegation is. They think they do, but they absolutely do not. So that's number one. You got to embrace that and do it correctly. So whatever you're doing right now in delegation, Mr. or Mrs. Listener, is probably wrong. And I would bet a lot of money on it because I've seen too many people doing it wrong. And I could explain that, although I know that for another time. The second thing is elimination of stress. Elimination of stress. A stressed company cannot perform at optimum capacity. So if you look at a stressed athlete, if an athlete is going through a ton of stress, he will not perform on the field as well as someone who is not stressed. So the same thing applies in business. If you can eliminate stress from your life, your employees' lives, you will ultimately eliminate it from the business, providing you a clearer path to success. That's the second thing. Number three is establish systems and processes. Now, the reason I put this at third position rather than the first position is because gurus who put systems and processes at the top of the list, well, look, what happens if you have a system and process that you don't have anybody to delegate to because you haven't embraced delegation? What if you have a system and a process that's just a stressed out system and process? Then you're still not going to operate at peak capacity. So delegation has to be first, stress elimination second, and then let's get into systems and processes. Let's figure that out. And then I'll teach you how to manage the systems and processes, not people, because managing systems and processes is much easier than managing people. And speaking of people, that's the fourth core principle, and that's invest in people. And I think too many times we look at our employees as numbers or as people that means to an end. You know, if you don't work, I'll hire another one of you. Actually, my son works for a company who said that to him one time. I can't believe he still works there, but the new ownership group came in and said, hey guys, I'm the new owner, you know, and you know, you're all replaceable. So just keep that in mind. If you don't do your job, we'll find somebody else. I thought, no, that type of company is going to be run by the person who owns it forever. Because if he has that type of attitude, he's not investing in his people correctly, he doesn't see them as valuable and necessary, then he's going to be stuck in the business. So I think investing into people is very specific. It starts with how you find and hire and onboard those people, how you train them for culture, how you train them for skills. Those are the four core principles I teach, and it's enveloped under this whole idea of mindset. I'm a big student of Napoleon Hill and Think and Grow Rich and understanding mindset and how thoughts lead to things and things are thoughts, and what you think about, you bring about. So that has to be on top of all that, or none of that works.
Last question before we go to the short answers. I've got a gentleman named Jake Stenziano, and he's saying to you, I don't want to exit my business. Why do I got to listen to your stuff? I love my business. I'm going to die with my business. What would you say to that person?
All right. You would be very similar to most of the people that I work with. They would say the same thing to begin with. So there's two layers to that. So number one, let's first analyze, are you telling the truth? Because what most entrepreneurs experience is something called synthetic happiness. You're doing something. It's providing you a means and a way of living that you kind of enjoy. So therefore, you convince yourself synthetically that you're happy with it. So a lot of people are dealing with synthetic happiness. Now, if in fact you do love it, and it is the core purpose of your reason for being, God put you on this earth to do X, whatever X is, okay, then that's good. So now we know we're dealing with the truth. But the second layer of that is, now, you love the business, but is that an excuse to be the linchpin for the business's success? And I think the answer to that is always a no. Because if you are the linchpin to a success and you get hit by a bus and you had 50 employees, what happens to those employees and their families? Now they can't pay their mortgages because you are the linchpin and you're not available to make things work. So maybe you love it, maybe you don't. Let's figure that out. And then second, do you really think that even if you love it, you should be the linchpin to your business success?
Request 30-second speaker for the floor. Yes. Granted. Great. So I'm starting to think I'm not doing a very good job in our business because our COO, now Gino, we have a bunch of our students keep asking me, what are you still doing this for? And, you know, I think people are throwing me some warning signs that they don't like the job I'm doing, must be, because everyone's asking, why are you still doing this? Why are you still doing, what are you going to? Here's the truth. I truly believe the pinnacle to business success, to summarize what he's been saying, is creating a well-oiled machine. That is the pinnacle, where the machine can run without you and it functions, it produces cash flow, it serves the residents, right? It serves your customer. That's what we're here for every day, right? We want to be the Chick-fil-A of apartments. That's our ultimate goal. The thing is, I like being involved. And if I stepped aside today, do I think the business would still run successfully without me? Yes. And I do think we're all replaceable. To counter what Jason was saying, I do think we're all replaceable. I think we have some very high performers on our team, but including myself, I am replaceable in this organization, and I understand that. I just enjoy being a steward of the business, being a steward of our funds, because ultimately we created this from nothing. We've grown it to where it is today, and I like seeing it going in a certain direction. I'm not involved in every aspect of the business, though. That's for damn sure at this point. But I do like joining on the weekly L10 meetings. I like being involved on some of the decision making that's going on from the day to day. That's something that I truly do enjoy. But to Jason's point, I don't love real estate, for example. Like, he doesn't love his lighting company, but I do love being involved in the business that's created a fantastic life for ourselves. So I don't know. I think if I ever get to the point where I'm like, I'm sick of this and I don't want to do it anymore, you know, definitely open to, you know, stepping aside or creating a more formalized board or something at that point. But I, you know what they say in The Wolf of Wall Street? I ain't leaving. I ain't fucking leaving. I'm just kidding.
And then he went to jail.
Oh, dude, thanks for that. Knock on wood, all right? Jeepers creepers, man.
Well, let me ask you a question, Jake. So let me ask you a question. How many hours a week do you put active hours into your business?
My average day is about 6 to 6, but I'm able to, you know, throughout the day, I'm able to get my workouts in, eating the way I want. I work from home, you know, most days of the week. So, you know, that's a, you know, fulfilled day for myself.
So 50, 60 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So if we look at this at 50, 60 hours, 50, 60 hours is producing the life that you want and the income that you desire. Like, that's what you just said, which I think it would still do that
if I stepped aside, if I'm being, you know, completely honest with myself.
So here's the bigger picture. And this is the layer of the onion, that this is why people join my mastermind, because there are a lot of people that start with me that feel the same way. Here's what happens. Okay. What if you could take the 50 to 60 hours that you take every single week to push the business uphill, to get it to do what you want, and you're liking it? What if we could get your portion of that down to 20? You're still in it. What would you do to the other 30 that you can't do now because you don't have time? Now, most people think, well, I don't have anything else I want to do. Yeah, but what if? What if you could figure out a different investment strategy? What if you could find a new apartment complex, but you've got that 30 that right now is 100% in what you've got to do every day? I had a guy in New York City. He had an energy company very similar to mine. He told me exactly what you told me. I love it. Don't want to get out of it. It's my baby. And I said, listen, trust me. We'll go through this. He went through my program. And at the end, I said, hey, what happened? And he said, I still don't want to exit. He said, but you know what? I have 30 hours a week now that I didn't have before. Now I'm opening a new division of my company. I've wanted to do this forever, was never able to. So he's still in. He's still working 50, 60 hours. But his 50, 60 hours is now positioned for greater generational wealth attainment.
That is a good component of what I do, though, because ultimately we have the team, the structure for the management piece. So, for example, this week we're closing 4 deals. We're expanding the organization. The growth is a big part of my day-to-day as well, right? And then so as we're growing this thing, it's not like the difference is I don't need to do any other businesses. I just want to do more multifamily deals. So grow and add more assets to the mix and stay in our lane. So there's no other business that I necessarily want to get into. So it's just stacking assets on the conveyor belt, as Gina would say. So that is a big component of it. So it's not I'm here pushing the boulder up the hill to make sure that people are paying their rents and, you know, all that stuff's happening. It's actually adding fuel and business growth to the organization and following. We have a 10-year plan, right, that where we want to hit, you know, X amount of, you know, units and 20% year-over-year growth in that 10 years, staying within, you know, this type of model. So,
well, you may be closer to all of that than most people are. So congratulations. Yeah.
So, but you know, I get it though. I get where people are coming from. I don't know. This really and truth. I can look you in the eye and say this is where I want to be right now in my life, and I'm okay with that. I don't have anything, you know, against that. So I don't know. Let's take a quick time out here from our sponsor.
Jake and Gino's Multifamily Mastery 6 is coming to the Gaylord Palms in Orlando, Florida this October 14th and 15th. Join Jake and Gino as they welcome special guests like Chris Voss, Luke Wren, David Green, and many more. Discover Jake and Gino's 3-step framework for real estate success, enabling students to accumulate $4 billion in assets. MM6 is the multifamily event of 2023 that you do not want to miss. Go to jakeandgino.com/MM6 to reserve your tickets today.
All right, gang, we're back. So based on a lot of what you're saying, not being involved too heavily in the day-to-day, are you looking at actually buying businesses versus starting them? Because it seems like a path to, you know, get to where you want much quicker than necessarily, you know, bootstrapping something from the ground up.
Yeah, I think my days of starting companies are over, man. I'm not interested in that anymore. The startup world is hard. Actually, my coaching company is probably the hardest business I've ever started in my life. That we could get into that for a whole nother reason. But I think you're right. I think you're exactly right, Jake. It's about, let's look at acquiring opportunities and then let's figure out how I can run this better. So I've looked at several acquisitions over the last couple of years. I'm wanting to do that as well. I'm also a real estate guy, so I want to increase my real estate portfolio. We're looking at some commercial stuff. I've got a small syndication that I run with my mastermind group. It's kind of a little private syndication that we do, and we're looking at investing in our first commercial property together. So I want to acquire. I'm not looking at startups anymore because they're just, I've done that, got a t-shirt. I've had 12 of them. I'm not interested in adding anymore.
It makes a lot of sense. How do you develop trust? Because I think one of the hardest things for folks, and I'll just give a little, you know, transparency to Gino and our growth. We didn't hire quick enough. That was one of the biggest issues. And you touched on delegating. And I think there's this issue with folks like Gino and myself where you start to delegate something, but you're afraid the person's not going to do it. So my question is, how do you develop that trust in order to allow yourself to delegate? Because I would say that was probably one of the biggest issues that he and I went through in our journey.
Well, so this is a universal law called the law of hindrance. This applies to everybody. If you are not experiencing success in any part of life, it could be relationship, financial, business, whatever it happens to be. If you're not experiencing success in any part of life, the law of hindrance tells us that it comes down to one of two reasons or both: lack of trust or lack of discipline. So if you're not experiencing success, which one is it, or is it both? So when you're looking at success in delegation, it comes down to that lack of trust and that lack of discipline. So there are three parts of delegation. It's not just assigning the task to which is what most people think that it is, but it's also entrusting that task of that person and empowering them to do it. So how do you build that? Well, actually, I teach my clients a 30-day training wheels to delegation. It's a very clear 6-step process. If you do these things, you can develop that trust over 30 days with someone. And at the end of 30, it's a dumpster fire. Okay, you did your 30-day test. Let's go test it with somebody else. The problem is most entrepreneurs test it for about a week. They didn't like what the they didn't like what the person did because they didn't do it their way. They give up, they quit, and they go to the next person. And they go to the next person and they're like, forget it. I'll do it myself. And that's actually confiscation, not delegation. So most entrepreneurs are confiscating, not delegating. And then the other side, like my problem is abdicating. It's where I assign a task and then never look back. I just hope they did it right. You know, so this pendulum swinging of abdication and confiscation, where we really need to be in the middle at delegation. And so I teach this training wheels to delegation that helps people know exactly how to do this over a 30-day process.
So you have the solopreneur. They're in the business. Maybe they have a couple employees. Where do they start scaling? Is it getting a coach, or is there something before that? Because a lot of people have a business, but they really just have a job, like you alluded to. What's that first step to start getting out of your own way?
I think the first step getting out of your own way is you got to have better perspective. You've got to have better perspective. And this is why I think a business coach is so pivotal in this. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Chris Doe, and I don't know if any of the listeners know who Chris is, but he's pretty big on YouTube. He's got a huge following, millions of people following him. And he was on my podcast just last week, and we were talking about, hey, what was his one key? And he mentioned that his one key was a business coach. And we talked about that, and we both have very similar stories. Like, I was doing pretty good before the coach, but man, that perspective that he brought in changed everything. It changed the trajectory. It changed my future. So I think getting perspective. Now, do you have to hire a coach for that? Not necessarily, but I think it's a quicker path. So hiring a coach, getting a mentor, getting involved in a mastermind, getting around people that are performing at the level that you want to perform at, and getting perspective. Not just a group of people telling you what to do, but get perspective. So that's the power of coaching, mentorship, and masterminds.
I really agree with that, because I got kind of hit in the gut. You know Jim Clayton from Clayton Homes?
I would love to meet him, but I know who he is. I've never met him.
He financed, I think it was our fifth deal, and he looked me straight in the eye when we were kind of having lunch talking about it, and basically said that he liked our, you know, our ambition and everything we were doing, but he was afraid about our systems and our scalability. And so from that point forward, Gino and I really invested heavily into systems coaching. We were scaling up. We did EOS, and it was, you know, when you talk about mentorship, I mean, that was somebody that I looked up to that just flat out told me, this is where you need to lean into right now. And so from that point forward, we went heavy with it, and it's changed our, you know, our complete trajectory. So I can't agree with that anymore. Any books that you recommend that you've read in the last year or so that you want to share with the folks?
I think the one book that every single person has to read is Think and Grow Rich. It's a book that we've heard about. People have heard about it for a long time. It was written in 1937 by Napoleon Hill. But I think you have to read that. That should be a yearly read. I think you should read it every year. I read it every day. Not the whole book, obviously, but I read portions of it every single day of my life. And then there's another book that is very similar, written in 1910. By a guy named Wallace D. Wattles, and it's called The Science of Getting Rich. The Science of Getting Rich. It's a short book. It's not actually that long at all.
Sounds like my kind of read.
I'm telling you, it's all about the mindset. It's all about what it actually leads to, how you do that. So both Think and Grow Rich and The Science of Getting Rich sound like it's all about money. And of course, it has something to do with money, but it's about your impact. It's about what you're able to accomplish in this world. So Wallace D. Wattles, The Science of Getting Rich, written in 1910, and then Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, written in 1937.
Awesome. All right, Gino, you ready?
I am ready. Jake, we have a young Jason Duncan. He's in the ministry. He's preaching Jesus. The only problem is it doesn't really line up with his core values. He's looking behind the curtain. He's like, I really don't want to be here. Jesus, tell me what to do. What's my next step? My next step is to be an eighth grade history teacher? I guess I'll go do that for a couple of years. Man, I love this. I am rocking it. I'm like top teacher in the whole county. And then guess what? My principal comes up to me and says, I'm sorry, Jason, you're doing really great, but we got to cut you because we don't have the funds. So what do I do
next?
Your
performance doesn't matter, Jason.
Right? What do I do next? So I'm going to go and, you know, start a hydrogen company. I have no idea what the hell that is. It was pretty cool because I got a go-kart with a hydrogen tank back there, but that's not long-term. The next thing I got to do is maybe start this LED company. Don't know what that's all about, but let me just start it. I mean, get going and get good. Driving down one day, look over a gap, over 2 million square feet, and I'm going to do the thing that I shouldn't do in sales. Give them a call and leave a message and pray and hope. And guess what? Jesus was there with them because you know what? They called him back. And since then, he sold millions of dollars of LED lighting. And I think the four tenets that he talked about, delegation, elimination of stress, systems and processes, and investing in people. People like Jason invest in people so he can build the businesses. That's the difference between someone who's a solopreneur and someone who's out there trying to build a business. Whether you want to sell your business or hold on to your business, I think a lot of the stuff that Jason talked about today is so crucial, so important. Even if you want to hold on to it, make it more valuable. That's the bottom line is, if you're Jake Stenziano and I'm never going to sell these assets, great. How do I make them more valuable? How do I make them easier to pass down to the next generation? I think that's one of the biggest things in this podcast is creating value for the company and being able to extract that and be able to go out and live the life that you want to live. So Jason, thanks. Exit without exiting. I want everyone to go pick up that book, and honor and a pleasure to have you on the show, my friend.
Well, the honor is mine, Jake and Gino. I've heard about you guys for a long time now. We're here and we've done the show. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure, my friend.
Our pleasure. Gang, as always, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He's the G-Daddy, and we make it happen. We'll see you next time.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.